Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussions, news, and interviews, presenting the film scene with Ileana Douglas. Ileana is an actress, writer, author, and film historian with a need to discuss movies that borders on obsession. You'll learn the history of movies one great story at a time. The film scene is the deep cuts of movie podcasts, featuring movies we love by the people who made them. And now, Ileana Douglas.
Hi everyone, it's Ileana Jashans. It's Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the film scene. Hey Jeff, how's it going?
It's going great. I was riveted by the primary article that you sent me for today's guest. He's done a lot of writing and work, but he's just, I call him a thought leader in the world of cinema.
Well, you know, it's been so exciting because it's been some of the fun parts of quarantine, and as I always say, discovering new people. And I just happened to come across that article by A.S. Hamra, an interview with him, which was about his book, which is called The Earth Dies Streaming, and we're going to talk about that. And I just was very taken with the writing and some of his opinions, and I said, we got to get him on the show. So,
yeah.
And it turns out we may be separated at birth. He's from Connecticut. We have a lot of parallel kind of fun stories. So we've been talking offline about some of those.
And you have the same magnifying glass.
We do. It turns out we went to the same movie theaters. It's going to be fun talking to him on the show. So, before, you know, I always like to recommend a couple books. Maybe one of these days I'll get into a book from this century. these are my, you know, back before COVID when we used to fly. These are my flying books. I've read them a million times, but they're light. So it's a series of books called Backstory, interviews with screenwriters of the Hollywood Golden Age. Every great screenwriter of the era. This is the 1930s, and this one, Backstory 2, which is very well worn, is screenwriters of the 40s and 50s. It's got my own coffee rings on it. And then Backstory 3, screenwriters of the 60s. There is so much useful information in here about writing, construction of scripts. So for all you writers out there, Backstory 1, 2, and 3, I highly recommend.
And there is a 4 now. I just looked it up.
You're kidding. It's amazing. See, but like, when did this happen?
2006. 14 years ago, Ileana.
Okay. Well, sorry. I've been busy.
No, you're fine. I'll get it for you. Because
get off my back, Jeff.
No, it's all good. I'm just so excited for this whole series. And now we're going to catch up to hopefully this century soon. But I love, especially you think about the 60s, especially to me, that was one of the most important times for writing in Hollywood.
Yes, I think so. Well, because everything was changing. It was the end of the studio era, and then the screenwriters coming in, and films like Bonnie and Clyde and Graduate just kind of changing up everything. And now who knows, again, which is one of the things we're going to talk about today, just, you know, show business post COVID and movies and movie criticism and where is it all going to go. Do we have any questions for this week? You know,
well,
I love questions.
When we started the show, our wonderful producer, who, you know, also guests on our show, Ryan, who is probably a bigger cinephile than even me, does have a question for Ileana. Ryan, hop in here.
I do, yes. Senior producer of Popcorn Talk. I took a Criterion deep dive this weekend. I started a new challenge. I don't know if you're familiar with Letterboxd, but it's a movie ranking like website app that you can kind of log things you've watched and see. People also have Letterboxd watched. I'm trying to watch their top 100 rated films, and there's a ton of Criterion on there. So this past weekend on my Criterion Collection subscription, I watched Persona for the first time, which is an Ingmar Bergman film. And I just became, this is the first time I ever watched one of his films. And I saw on the Criterion website, they have top 10s for a lot of filmmakers, actors, actresses. And your number one on there was an Ingmar Bergman movie, Wild Strawberries. And you said that you wrote about how you were on Easy to Assemble. I just wanted to hear more about, like, why was that the first film you chose to watch of his?
Well, in my era, I had missed Ingmar Bergman. You know, all the only thing I knew about Bergman was he was the, you know, Woody Allen kind of satirized Bergman. But because of my age, I had missed all of his films, and it wasn't as easy to get, you know, to watch films in those days. You had to wait till they were on TV or see them in a revival house. And so when I was doing the show sponsored by IKEA, I thought, you know, I'm going to take my deep dive into Ingmar Bergman. So I started watching his films, and I watched this film, Wild Strawberries. And in the film, he goes in and out of reality. It's a road trip movie, but it's an old man who's on his way to receive this award. At the film, it's this journey back into his life. But what was so fascinating to me was that Bergman dipped in and out of reality. So the old man would look, and he would see himself as a young man, and then we'd go back into him being an older man. And it just blew my mind, because I didn't know, in terms of learning about conventions of cinema, that's always the way that I thought in my head. I would daydream, but I didn't think you could actually put that into your writing. And so it freed me up so much to make the show easy to assemble, that kind of, it's my journey, but I can also look back at my life. I can daydream, you know, and then go back into reality. And it's just an incredibly moving film too. You're too young to look back on your life.
You know, Ileana, you're not alone in terms of filmmakers who consider it one of the most important films for their career. Kubrick lists it as his second favorite movie ever. So
it's an incredible film. And, you know, Ryan, it's so funny that you would start out with Persona, because I always watch films. I start from the very beginning of the first films, you know, that Bergman wrote, and then he became a director. And then Wild Strawberries was kind of one of his real first big successes in the 1950s. But Persona, that's the movie where he kind of went crazy, like, it went wild 60s. So the fact that you started with that.
Well, that was actually going to be a follow-up question of mine, which was, I'm shocked I loved it. And now I'm intrigued to start at the beginning and go through. But on the opposite end, another director, Tarkovsky, which I know Bergman and him kind of had a mutual admiration, I just picked one at random to start with him, and I think I had the opposite effect. I watched Mirror, and that was just too much, too fast. And I was just wondering, like, do you think that there are – is that what you recommend for all these directors? Should you start at their first film, or do you think that there's usually, like, a gateway to some of these more artistic directors?
For me, I started the beginning, because I like to see the progression. And so that, therefore, you know, when you take a movie like Persona, you see how he had certain ideas and he was expanding and expanding and expanding. And then he gets to Persona. It's like, oh, wow, you're blowing my mind with all that, you know, with identity. You know, there's so many, and the just the whole visual of Persona too is incredible. But I mean, I hear you. You can watch a certain movie and just go, that's it, I'm turned off from that director. And you maybe starting at the beginning, or you give him three tries or something, you know. I mean, there are certain movies like, you know, Jean-Luc Godard. I love, you know, Breathless is incredible. But then some of his other movies are just like, it just seem like they're weirdly cinematic to be cinematic. So
I feel that way about, like, Terrence Malick a little bit. I feel that way about Werner Herzog too. He's so hit or miss for me, you know. So Ryan, the way I feel about it is, if you're showing someone who's not necessarily a student of film a director, I think start with one of their, like, quote, safer movies, something that is a little more generally loved. Like, if I'm thinking about even like a Damien Chazelle, I still think Whiplash is his masterpiece, but maybe you're safer to start with La La Land, and then he's just an example if you're showing someone for the first time, rather than starting with their first film.
I just thought that was so interesting, because one of my best friends who's also kind of doing this Letterboxd challenge with me, they saw Wild Strawberries as one of the favorites, and then when they watched Persona, they were already in that mindset of, like, we're going to get something kind of wild here, we're going to go a little introspective.
Right.
It's almost like you learn how to watch the movies by watching some of their early films, so and preparing you in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I've become fascinated by the person making the film as well as the film. And Bergman himself was such a complex man, and, you know, his relationship with many of the actresses that he was working with, it all blends into me to be one gigantic movie. So that's why, again, I like going back to the beginning. I mean, but wait till you get to, you know, his epic, Fanny and Alexander.
Which I also noticed, I didn't know this before, there's a theatrical and a TV version.
Watch the theatrical version, but you're gonna need 2 days to watch it. But and the very first Bergman movie I ever saw was Fanny and Alexander, on a movie screen, it took me years to go back to see Bergman. It wasn't until doing the IKEA show, and you know, and looking at Swedish films of the that period, because there were other filmmakers too that were making movies not as successfully as, you know, as him.
Got it. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. God, what are you? I'm trying to think of your next Bergman movie that you should watch.
The one I was gonna watch was Scenes from a Marriage. That was the one. No, you wouldn't recommend.
Man, you're going right to, I feel like you're going right to dessert.
Maybe I should save that.
I think so. I feel like I want to force you to go back and see some of the, you know, some of the earlier ones, Smiles of a Summer Night, you know, which some of those earlier ones. Got to have them up on my Winter Light. You know, he was like Picasso, because he went through all these different types of films. And then his later films, like Scenes from a Marriage, are completely stripped down. So the early ones have more of the artifice and illusion and magic, occult, things like that.
I've only seen The Seventh Seal. I know I need to broaden my Bergman taste, but I was very moved by that film.
That's a beautiful film. I mean, that might be one for you to see, Ryan, The Seventh Seal, which also has a lot of strange
symbolic.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll be the next one.
You know what, though? Maybe not during a pandemic. I now feel bad recommending it. It's talk about an anxiety-inducing film. Maybe stay away from The Seventh Seal.
Yes. Now, any other questions, or should we bring in AS? Because we're going to do a lot of talking.
We should bring him in, because let's bring him in, yeah.
That's enough of me.
So, Ileana, you've discovered AS Hamra through this article that you sent me, right? Now you've gone through the rabbit hole.
Yes, I have. I've been spending my last couple days reading everything that he wrote. He worked on, which again is another, I never heard of The Baffler. I never heard of it.
A.S. Hamra is the author of The Earth Dies Streaming, which is a film book that's talking about modern movements in cinema and television. Of course, he writes for all these publications Ileana mentioned. And it's just, you know, there are so many acclaimed, you think of like Pauline Kael and critics whose reputations precede them.
Yes.
And I feel like it's important for us to have current contemporary critics who are adding to the conversation. And I feel like he's one of them.
Especially people who have a technique of great writing. So A.S. Hamra, please welcome you to the show. But may I call you Scott?
Yes, please do call me Scott. Hi.
Okay, thank you. But I love your moniker.
Oh, thanks.
People sometimes call me ID. So you
okay.
can call me.
All right. Got it.
As I said at the top of the show, I'm thrilled that I just discovered your writing, and I've been enjoying. Is it more fun to have a new fan as opposed to long-standing fans, like someone just comes upon your work?
Well, it's great. Anybody that reads my work is great. I love them all. And I mean, it's an honor for you to read it, of course, because I've seen you in many films over the years and watched you on TCM as well.
Thank you, on TCM. And as we were saying, which is the strangest thing, we don't want to go down the Connecticut rabbit hole, but apparently we once were in the same New Haven train depot on our way to our parents'.
Yes, it was the main train station, New Haven. And we're from the same part of Connecticut, and we grew up there at the same time, approximately.
And we went to see the scene. We went at the same movie theaters. So movie theaters that I mentioned in my book, you went there too. Do you, since you grew up in Connecticut, do you remember the first movie you saw in Connecticut in the theater?
I think the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater in Connecticut was maybe The Aristocats in Meriden. I'm not sure where. And it also might have been the Poseidon Adventure somewhere.
Yeah. That would have been,
The very first film I ever saw, I saw it on an airplane. It was The Love Bug. It was The Love Bug. And it was projected on an airplane. My family and I were going to California. And it was projected on... in CinemaScope on film in, you know, like 16 millimeter Super 8 CinemaScope. And it was The Love Bug, Herbie the Love Bug. And I thought it was great. I loved it. I was sitting on an airplane for the first time flying across the country and they're showing a movie and it was great. And I thought the whole future was going to be like that.
I can imagine. Now, do you get like me where you watch a movie where a movie seems better when you're on an airplane?
Well, I don't know if a movie seems better when I'm on an airplane, but I'll watch almost any movie on an airplane.
Me too. And
there's a piece in my book about, so I haven't seen any animated films since like the early 90s, not even one, but I watched The Boss Baby on an airplane.
It was better.
And I didn't really like it very much, but I wrote a piece about, you know, why I don't like to watch animated movies and what it was like to see The Boss Baby on an airplane after not seeing any animated films for more than 20 years.
Before, your book is called The Earth Dies Dreaming. Now, when did your book, which is right there.
This is my book. It's now also available as an ebook from the publisher N+1 Books.
And can we plug the actor who did a promotion for your book? Because I think this is the coolest thing because we started the COVID, so you weren't able to do a book tour and all of that.
Well, no, my book came out in November of 2018, so I did do a book tour.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and the very last dates I did of the book tour were in Seattle in the middle of February. So while I was in Seattle in February, the whole COVID thing started. I mean, the whole COVID thing, that sounds very glib. I don't mean to be glib about it.
Yes.
So I flew back on a plane from Seattle on February 23rd, I think it was. And there was one guy on the plane with a mask. And it was a very packed plane. And I was like, wow, that guy's really taking this seriously. He's got a special mask on and everything. And then when I got back to New York, it became a big problem and people started to die. Yeah. And I basically been in my apartment since March 10th. And I haven't had a haircut or anything, you know. And it's been terrible in New York, as you probably know.
I know. It's surreal just watching. You know, it's been like a whole roller coaster because unlike a movie, this does not seem to have an ending.
No ending in sight.
You know, as much as we wanted to create an ending, and I remember when it started, I said, oh, I can do this, you know, because I lived on a mountain for 4 months in Alive. So I sort of looked at it as a 4 month thing.
Yeah.
And not going to be.
So. Well, it's only, I mean, March, April, May, now the third month is ending. But I haven't really, I've just been at home, you know, and I'm not a good cook. And, you know, I know, you know, people's parents who've died and other things. It's been, you know, it's been rough. But that was the end, that was the last event I did for my book right before I came back. And now the book was going to go into another printing, but they couldn't do another printing because N+1 magazine handles their book orders themselves. And their office is closed because of COVID. So there's an ebook now. And the magazine where I'm a film critic, The Baffler, is still being published. Well, it was The Baffler is a magazine that was started by Tom Frank in 1989 or so, or 1988. Okay. The guy that wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's been published since then, and I've been the film critic there since January of this year. And the new issue just came out, and they're still doing everything in print and online, too.
And
the book, they couldn't do another one, so it's an ebook now, too.
And you got somebody, can you mention who you got to do a cameo for?
Oh, right. So to promote the book, I got the idea of hiring an actor from Cameo, the website and app that employs actors and other entertainers to do shout outs to people on their birthdays or on their anniversary or for different kinds of events.
Yes.
So the publisher ponied up and hired the actor Eric Roberts to do one for my book. And he did a great job. And he, you know, I mean, he's a great actor. I've loved him since, you know, the 80s when I saw him in Runaway Train and The Pope of Greenwich Village. But he did a great, great job. And you can see it on Twitter. And it's in my Instagram, and it's really great.
As soon as we finish the show, I'm going to check it out because I started doing Cameo, and you know, I take it really seriously. I think I end up watching other people's cameos. A friend of mine said, "Why would you be interested in a cameo that somebody does for somebody else?" And I guess that's what's fascinating about it.
Well, the only reason I heard about Cameo, I guess, is because people are talking about Vince Neil's cameos. You know, the guy from Motley Crue.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. How he wasn't really into it, I guess. But Eric Roberts did a great job. He talked about his father-in-law, who's the screenwriter, David Fifield, who wrote 3 Days of the Condor. And he talked about film critics and what he likes about them. And, you know, people think that they're scripted, but they're not scripted. As you probably know, you can only give the person that you hire, I think, 200 characters worth of instruction as to what you want.
Yes.
So he spoke for about 2 minutes just based on, this guy has an ebook of his book coming out. We'd like you to say something nice about it.
There was somebody, you know, that was a big fan of Ghost World. And I mean, I must have done 5 minutes. My manager made fun of me. I said, well, I was hoping maybe, you know, Hollywood would script my cameo, you know.
My friend told me this morning that your portrayal of an art teacher in Ghost World is the only accurate portrayal of a high school art teacher in any movie.
Thank you. And we grew up in Connecticut, so it was based on people. You know, that wonderful thing that they had of encouraging you and crushing you at the same time.
Well, when I was in middle school, we had an art teacher named Miss Christie, who was she was a real hippie type. You know, she was like the last hippie.
Yeah.
She was very encouraging to everyone.
Well, I was lucky with them. They, as written in the script, it was very different. And they, luckily for me, they let me, I had a certain point of view of how I wanted to take the character, and thank God Terry Zweigoff let me do that. And we added the movie, The Mirror Father. I wanted her to have I thought she was a failed performance artist.
Ah, yes.
And then fell into teaching, you know.
I guess that movie's been on a Criterion Channel this month, so a lot of people have been talking about it recently.
Yes, they have. I know. Yeah. I was thinking of Seymour, it being in quarantine would be a funny.
Oh, see, right.
He's miserable anyway. So I wanted to talk about some of your things that popped out to me that I absolutely loved. One of them was this idea that you said that critics have been forced to become publicists for films. Mm. And I wanted you to expand on that idea because I think that's very true. And getting away from the kind of movie reviews that when you and I were kids, that we really looked forward to reading of a review of a film, and it was very much in depth, and that's all sort of gone away.
Well, there's still places that publish longer pieces on films, but there aren't as many as there used to be. The places I write for do that. But, you know, since the 80s, really, film criticism has become part of the publicity machine that exists to promote films, not to discuss them or think about them. And of course, we've seen the culmination of that in Rotten Tomatoes the last decade or so. which, as you know, aggregates reviews based on rating them, whether they're positive or negative. And ever since I became a Rotten Tomatoes approved critic, which is something that happens to you, I mean, I didn't ask for that. You know, I think some people ask for that. I didn't ask for that. It just happened.
Congrats.
I've noticed in reading the, I've noticed in the few times I've looked at my page, they make a page for you. Probably 20% of the reviews are, they rate positive reviews as negative reviews and negative reviews as positive reviews. They mostly make mistakes on the side of saying something was a positive review that was a negative review. So there's about a 20%, it's like a poll. It's like a 20%, that's pretty high. There's a 20% discrepancy there, I think.
I know, I was shocked to find that out. And then there's also a funny thing. You had written about Magnificent Ambersons, and on Rotten Tomatoes, they had posted it as a negative review.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I'd written in part of a piece about a number. There's a couple of pieces about Orson Welles in my book, but I had written something short about his film, The Magnificent Ambersons, and Rotten Tomatoes said it was negative. Because I guess I talked about how the studio cut that film and threw away the footage that they cut. They thought it was a negative review, but it wasn't. So I had to intervene on that one. I don't like to intervene with them.
I mean, how would they get that perception, though? It's just so bizarre.
I mean, I don't really know how it works. They have people that read all your reviews, and then they decide whether they're negative or positive reviews. I wrote a review. I try to write so that the pieces can't be excerpted for publicity purposes. I don't want them to ever show up on a poster or DVD or an ad online or in the trailer or anything like that. I guess it's confusing to some people, some readers. There was one, I reviewed the film The Mule by Clint Eastwood, which I liked, but they thought it was a negative review because I talked about different aspects of the film. And I guess if you're not, it's hard to tell if you're not just saying it's a masterpiece or you hated it or whatever.
Yeah, that must really cramp your style as a writer to.
I never thought about it because it was never a goal of mine to be listed in Rotten Tomatoes, So I just never thought about this stuff, except for one of the first things I ever published in the 90s was about a very obscure film that's pretty good called Begotten. It's quite good, actually. Uh-huh. And when the film came out, they quoted my piece about it on the video box, and it bothered me. Back in the day when you rented VHS tapes at the video store, in like the mid-90s this was.
Yeah.
It bothered me to see my name, the quote from my piece, because I wasn't really happy with that piece. And I just felt like an idiot somehow, even though I liked the film and I thought the director was very interesting. The whole thing was kind of great. The film's kind of great. But something about it really bothered me, to see that there. And I'm not sure why. It just was seemed gross to me, kind of.
When you were, the collection of reviews is from 2002 to 2018.
Yeah.
And you're going back and culling all your reviews, what were some of the movies of the era that really stood up, or did sometimes your opinions about the movies change when you read the reviews?
My opinions about various films have changed over the years. In the introduction to my book, I write about how I didn't used to like Kubrick, but now I do.
Yes.
But in this case, most of the films that I wrote about, my thoughts on them haven't really changed that much. I don't think so.
Can I quickly jump back? I hate to interrupt. It's funny. I have a complicated relationship with Kubrick personally. I feel like I'm supposed to like Kubrick, but I mostly only like his comedies. I love Dr. Strangelove. I like Full Metal Jacket. Why do you feel like your relationship with Kubrick has changed, and what made it change?
Well, one thing that made it change was when Eyes Wide Shut came out, his last film. It got very bad reviews, but I loved it when it came out. I thought it was great. I thought it was his best film that I'd seen, back in 1999. And that made me go watch his other films again that I hadn't liked very much, that I thought were lifeless or kind of dead or too cold or, you know, various criticisms I had of them. So when I did that, I started liking them a lot again. And also I think that, you know, getting older has made me like them more, because they have a kind of, bitter view of, you know, humanity.
Yeah.
And I also think the American life in America and American society has gotten so much worse in the last, you know, since the 80s, that the anger and bitterness in some of his films makes a lot more sense now.
Hmm.
So when I was quite young, I was working in a movie theater when Full Metal Jacket came out, and I didn't really like it at the time. You know, it just seemed so aggressive and terrible. You know, it's a very dark view, and I didn't really understand why it was being made at that time. It didn't really resonate with me. But now I understand those things more, because life, you know, teaches you certain lessons, you know, over time.
Mm-hmm.
And those films, you know, kind of are about that. Even A Clockwork Orange, I think, which was a film I didn't really like in high school. But, you know, I was too sensitive.
Yeah,
that's probably me.
Yeah, now, especially these days, it makes more sense. You know, we live in a very violent society that is marked by an authoritarian impulse that is, you know, hurting us all during COVID and, you know, hurting specific other people, you know, because of the authoritarian nature of policing and other things now. So that film like that makes more sense now.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the experience, I've talked about this on the show, and he's been on the show, my friend who's a comedian, Wayne Fetterman, he never saw Barry Lyndon, and so I took him to see this beautiful re-release of Barry Lyndon at Cinerama Dome, and he absolutely hated it. We got in a huge fight afterwards.
Why didn't he like it? Was it too slow for him?
I guess so. You know, so again, sometimes with people you just can't. He didn't like Ryan O'Neill. He thought he was too contemporary. I don't, you know, but again, we have fights with people, but it's like, I just go into the movie and I accept the director's point of view, who they cast. I have no problems with, I hate when people say, in fact, oh, that actor was horrible, or he was stiff, or they never did another movie. I kind of almost enjoy whoever they cast in the film, because I think that that's part of the film.
Yeah. Well, that film, I mean, not a lot of films are made like Barry Lyndon now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what other films your friend Wayne likes, but maybe if you saw it again, he would like it more the second time. You should take him to see it again.
Wayne and I fight. We laugh about this all the time. I took him. He never saw a Fellini movie, and I took him to see Roma.
Oh, that's my favorite Fellini movie. Roma. It's the best one.
Yeah, he got up and left. At the extended scene in the church with all the parade of the, you know, the Catholic Church and the Catholic symbolism. He just shook his head.
Did he stay for the traffic jam scene?
Yeah.
I don't see how you could leave that film after you see that traffic jam section of the film, or the frescoes disappearing from the walls and the.
He liked that scene. He liked that scene.
Or the spaghetti eating. You know, when all the people are eating spaghetti in the plaza. That's his best movie. I love that film.
I know, but you know,
the thing about your friend has bad taste.
You have to have. I mean, to me, don't you have friends that you have movie rivalries with and go, you're an idiot, you don't understand that film, or
no?
All get along. You all.
I mean, I get along. I get along with everybody. Yeah.
Well, Scott, there's got to be movies that are widely acclaimed that you roll your eyes at. I'd be curious about some of the like beloved films that most critics like that you don't.
Well, which ones?
If there's any that come to your mind, I don't know.
Well, gosh, I mean, there's a lot of films that are overrated, especially around the Oscar season. You know, N+1, the magazine I used to write for before I wrote for The Baffler. Actually, I did one for The Baffler this year, too. It would have me, I would write about every single film that was nominated for an Oscar. I did it most years. So when you do that, you see a lot of films that have gotten a lot of praise that oftentimes aren't very good. Mm. And a lot of times I forget about them after I write about them.
Yeah.
You know, because they're, you know, a film, you know, it's funny, a film that I didn't really like very much, a lot of people liked, was The Wife.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Glenn Close.
Yes, yeah. Glenn Close.
With Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce and Christian Slater. Slater was, I love Christian Slater in it though. I think I love
him. I thought he was the best thing in the movie.
Yeah. But I didn't like that film. I just thought it didn't seem, as a writer, you know, it just didn't seem, you know, it takes place in Connecticut though. You may recall a lot of it takes place in Connecticut. Speaking of Connecticut.
Yes.
I didn't like it, but that was another film of Rotten Tomatoes said that my review was a positive review.
Interesting.
Yeah, that would drive me crazy.
I wanted Slater to take his book that she actually wrote and start underlying words in it like he does in Heathers when he underlines Eskimo.
I had the same issue with the film. It was we used to say in my, because our family was a movie going family, and we used to always have this phrase. It kept threatening to be good.
It kept threatening to be good. I don't know if that one ever actually threatened to be good.
Well, you know, it was always on the verge of like, oh, this is going to go somewhere. Oh, no, and then it went back to kind of just being sort of typical.
But, you know, I don't mean to pick on The Wife, because there's a lot of other ones, too. But that one just came to mind because we were talking about Rotten Tomatoes before.
Yes.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of classic cinema, though. Like, do you regard, for example, Citizen Kane as a masterwork of American film? Or are there AFI treasures that you disagree with? That most cinephiles hold up.
I don't know what's on the AFI treasures list. I don't really pay attention to those AFI lists.
Yeah.
I look at the Sight and Sound lists when they do the decade, every decade. I don't think that Vertigo is necessarily the best film ever made, but I love Vertigo. I think it's great. Citizen Kane too.
Vertigo has grown in popularity, I think mainly because of, you know, Martin Scorsese, Spielberg. They really love that movie. It fits in, I think, with the
movie. Yeah, a lot of cinephiles, a lot of cineasts, I guess is the right word, really love Vertigo. It has a special quality for people who aren't necessarily just interested in entertainment in Hitchcock film. For people who don't like the films with Grace Kelly, in other words, they like Vertigo more because it does less to bring the audience in. Mm-hmm. Yet it's so moving and romantic. Well, you know, when I saw Vertigo when I was in high school in a movie theater in Connecticut, actually. I didn't like it when I was, you know, 16. I didn't like it at all when I was 16. It's not a film for kids.
Yeah.
You have to have had your heart broken to understand Vertigo, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. I love Vertigo, but I do think it's always funny the way it's grown in popularity, and it is completely about the, you know, male gaze. dismisses the underlying horrifying aspects.
Yes. His manipulation of her is so extreme that it subverts the male gaze in some ways.
Yeah.
But you know, when the Sight and Sound poll first said that Vertigo was the best film, you know, there were a lot of reactions. You know, places like Slate that have to always do counterintuitive pieces, you know, people wrote, oh, it's not that great. Here's what's wrong with Vertigo.
Right. But
I don't like pieces like that. I don't do pieces like that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people consider my judgments to be harsh a lot of the time. But I don't really write pieces that are trying to say something that is considered great is not great.
Another thing I want to ask you, which again, I love this, you say some things that I believe, this is what you said, talking about people writing about movies online, people's initial reactions to a film that for some reason they feel the need to get out to the public, and what people, you know, their takes on cinema. Right. And you're right. Like with people, there's so many times people send me their blogs or what they've written about a movie. And what is that need to get their point of view out?
Well, there's a lot of people who are, you know, entertainment journalists or I'm not really sure how to characterize some of them.
Yeah.
Who see films and festivals and then they rush to their phone as soon as the movie's over to say something about it on Twitter or wherever. And, you know, that style, of course, is meaningless now because of COVID.
Right.
There's no festivals, really, that people can rush out of and do that. People that are, you know, festivals are going to show films online and things now. There's not this impetus to be the first person to say something about something right now. Because yeah. The nature of this pandemic is changing how people go to see the movies and how they consume or watch cinema.
Yeah, I mean, the person who has to tweet, I just came out of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's not very thoughtful to do that.
I know.
But, you know, I mean, some people just, a lot of social media is just jokes. So people are kind of auditioning their material sometimes, you know. They're workshopping it.
Like my cameos.
Like cameos, yeah.
Now, you also talked about, which you were all experiencing it in Hollywood, how COVID is going to reconfigure Hollywood in every aspect. And anybody who says they have a handle on it is not, nobody has a handle on it.
Oh, yeah, no one knows anything right now. You know, I guess it was William Goldman that wrote, said nobody knows anything. What's the exact title? I can't remember now. But I think that's more true than ever. No one knows anything. And a lot of pieces have been coming out lately about what movie theaters are going to be like. And, you know, I'm finding them all very self-serving. There was one piece about how movies are going to be like Apple, movie theaters are going to be like Apple stores now. I thought that was ridiculous. And I think a lot of writers are positioning themselves to try to be, you know, players somehow in the new world of movie going that might emerge if this goes on and on and on. I really don't think that movie theaters are going to change that much, except they'll put up, you know, barriers at the concession stand so that the people that sell popcorn don't get infected. And I think what movie theaters will really do, what something they've wanted to do for a long time, is get rid of cashiers.
Yeah.
They'll just eliminate those jobs completely. So you have to buy your tickets online or from a machine. And, you know, they've really been trying to do that for a long time. I think that one of the reasons a lot of theater chains brought in assigned seating that you had to choose was to get us prepared for the elimination of cashiers.
That's another thing. I think that was my very next question. You're the first person who ever mentioned the fact that this idea that you can't pick where you want to sit, I find infuriating.
Oh, yeah. It's very undemocratic. It's not American to do that. I don't understand that. I know, you know, if you go to see a movie in France, for instance, they might have an usher that brings you to the seat and then you have to tip the person. It's not like that here. You just pick out some seats, then you can sit in them or not. You know, oftentimes you go to the movies, there's not that many people here. There's not that many people there. You don't have to sit in those seats anyway. Sometimes yeah. I pick the seats and sit in the seats in front of those. Then no one can sit behind me. you know, I just don't like anything about that. You know, and then they want you to do it online so they can charge you more money for the surcharge. I don't like assigned seating in movie theaters. That's not what a movie theater is to me. It's general admission means you can sit anywhere. And it also means if someone's sitting next to you who you don't like, you can move your seat.
Totally. You know? Or yell at them or, you know, with these days, you can't say a word.
Unless people are texting. Someone just texted me.
So you mentioned now, how many movies do you think you've seen while we've been quarantined?
I've been keeping a list of the films that I've seen since it started. I know I've seen 102 films at home since March 10th.
I wonder how many. I've been seeing a lot, but I haven't counted them. So give me some of your, are you revisiting old movies or?
Well, I'm seeing new films that I'm going to write about.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing that right now. And I'm seeing, there's a lot of, I have holes in my, you know, knowledge of classic cinema. So there's certain directors who, you know, who made certain prominent filmmakers whose work maybe I haven't seen some of the key film. Like I saw Throne of Blood by Kurosawa during this. I'd never seen that before, which was great. Great, great anti-authoritarian film in which a cruel dictator is killed at the end with, you know, hundreds of arrows.
Oh,
So I've been doing a lot of, you know, catching up on things I've missed over the years, but I've also been watching a lot of films that are about plagues and self-isolation and quarantine and viruses.
I did that the first week, and then I would say, yeah, this is
a lot. I've got a lot left. Yeah, some of them have been real eye-openers, you know. And in terms of Hollywood's total failure to anticipate this, you know, one thing I was thinking about in terms of Hollywood and COVID is how people's yoga instructors were much more prepared for this than studio executives. So if you're a yoga instructor, you just set up a camera and now you have a whole class of people that you're, you know, that you're doing yoga with virtually and you're still making money. But studio executives weren't, their thinking wasn't even advanced as a yoga instructors. So now they're just left holding the bag completely because everything is still based on opening weekends and box office for the first couple of weeks of a film's premiere. And what I learned by watching some films about Hollywood films specifically, most of the films I have watched about plague and so on have not been Hollywood films. But if you watch Outbreak from 1995 or Contagion, the Soderbergh film, from 2011, you see that Hollywood had already covered this subject. So just like the federal government, they should have known what to do when this happened because they've made films about this in which it's all laid out what's going to happen. And in fact, an outbreak, the epidemic starts in a movie theater. Someone coughs and we see the droplets animated in computer generated imagery come out of the cougher's mouth and fall into other people's, you know, noses and mouths and eyes in the audience. So, you know, it shows you how little meaning a lot of films have in the eyes of the people that make them. The subject matter is not important, you know, and they just forget about this stuff immediately and go on to the next kind of material, whatever it is. But, you know, in seeing a film from 1995, you know, in a lot of ways, a film from the 90s still looks contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing one from 2011, it's amazing how Hollywood was completely unprepared for this. Whereas people that work for them, like yoga instructors, figured it out right away.
Yeah, I you know, the in terms of coming back, they're one of the big things that they're talking about is not having any extras.
Yeah. Well, I think there's going to be a lot more green screen movies now. A lot more animated films with voice acting and, you know, the background artists can just be generated in the computer now.
But don't you think that too is, you know, the last thing I want to see is 100 movies that only star Anthony Hopkins or something, you know? Like, the brilliant idea is going to be, let's just get one person and we'll do a one-man show, like that there'll be 10 movies that are one-man show movies.
Well, I would love it if there were 10 Anthony Hopkins one-man show movies. That's called a television series, I think.
That's
I think the blockbuster era is over. I think it's done. Yeah. And I think a lot of the hopes of Hollywood studios, especially ones that are going to have streaming as a main, you know, function of their revenue, was based on the continuing success of blockbusters. And I think this pandemic just makes that look like stuff from another era now. It's overnight, it all became very dated.
That the shocking thing to me is to look at 2019, and this is another thing you wrote about too, 2019 was actually a really good year. The biggest tragedy for me is that 2019 was actually, I thought, a really, really interesting and good year in films.
Oh, I thought it was too. Yeah, I thought it was a real pushback year against the superhero trend.
Yeah,
you know, the biggest box office movie was, you know, the second Avengers, or I don't know what number, the last Avengers film, of course, made more money than any other individual film. But the films that were coming out were not franchise films. They were not IP films. They're not intellectual property films. The ones that were really good. And there were quite a few of them. And it is sad that that's kind of been nipped in the bud by this.
I felt like we were in this renaissance of films.
Well, I also thought it was good that streaming services like Netflix were releasing things theatrically and even renting films here, renting theaters here in New York to do that, like the Paris Theater, which they took out a long-term lease on after the success of Marriage Story there.
Yeah.
And, you know, because of the pandemic, my book is called The Earth Dies Streaming, but I didn't belong to any streaming services at all. I saw every movie in a movie theater, which you can do if you live in New York City.
Yeah.
And you're writing about them. But because of COVID, I got streaming services and I got Netflix, and I thought it was going to be a lot of movies like Roma, the Cuarón one, not the Fellini one, and The Irishman and Marriage Story and Atlantics by Matty Diop. I thought it was going to be a lot of films like that. And the last three Netflix movies I've seen have just been, you know, not worth watching, really.
Yeah. You need your Criterion. There's a lot of, you know.
Right.
Amazon Prime actually has a lot of movies. You have to buy them or rent them, but.
Yeah. I mean, places like Amazon Prime and Criterion Collection are really real winners in this situation. Because people have a hunger for a better kind of cinema now.
I will say the optimism I have, though, you know, you're talking about last year's a great year for film. I look at movies like Parasite, and I know I liked Marriage Story more than Eliana did, but to me, those are two movies that you could still maybe make in a COVID-plagued world. They're small casts, and besides like the storm scene in Parasite, rarely are there more than two or three people in a scene. So to me, like, you think of a movie like The Big Chill even, I hope we kind of push more towards story-driven small ensemble movies, which I think a lot of the best movies of last year were.
Well, Parasite, what was the other one you mentioned besides Parasite?
Marriage Story
really depended on, I wasn't crazy about Marriage Story either, but Marriage Story really depended on the star power of Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson. And I don't know what, perhaps they worked for less than they usually do to be in a film like Marriage Story, but, you know, I think that, I'm not sure how that's going to affect, I think this is going to affect actors' salaries adversely. And Parasite actually does have a lot of large scenes. A lot of it was exteriors in the city. And there was the birthday party scene, which is the kind of culmination of the whole film.
Yeah.
Featured a lot of actors outdoors. It's not so much that it has a small cast or there's not a lot of crowd scenes or what have you, but just that the way that films are made on location or with large groups of people who are in the crew too, you know, none of that is really possible right now. And you read stories about how, you know, production companies want to go shoot in countries where there's not a lot of COVID and they're going to get extra money to go shoot in Bhutan or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they're kind of dreaming. I don't think that's really going to work.
The cast is going to quarantine together. Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like a movie itself.
It's
like a Fassbender film. You know, the whole cast is together and they're just drinking and they hate each other and they're having affairs and they're drunk and everyone hates the script and, you know, it's just not going well.
Another thing I wonder about is I've been watching a lot of movies and every time there's a love scene, I go, we're never going to see that again. I wonder if there's ever going to be, every time someone's kissing or touching each other, I think, are we ever going to have that in a movie again? Are people going to be so repelled by touching one another when this is over?
If you see films that were made, you know, right before this all happened that are coming out now, and there's a lot of hugging or kissing or other kinds of, you know, if it's a comedy, there might be some like gross stuff that couldn't happen now. You know, it does seem odd. But when you see older films, it doesn't seem odd.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think it's too early to say what's going to happen with all this stuff now, because so much depends on you know, treating the disease properly, which isn't really happening now. But
no,
if there's a vaccine, you know, then everything could just go back to normal and they can give Robert Downey Jr. $75 million to be Iron Man again. You know,
that'll be it. I mean, again, who knows? I don't know. It's a very reflective time. Because
there's a lot of reflection going on in the homes in Los Angeles these days.
I just watch movies and I don't have much interaction even with people, but I'm curious with people, you know, you have to have you're right, in the upper echelons, letting the nannies go and, you know.
Or if they do that, you know, I'm sure, you know, I'm from my old job, I still know some people in the film industry and the television industry in Los Angeles. And, you know, I think a lot of people are skirting the quarantine in various ways if they can afford to do that, you know, with their personal staff and so on.
Yeah.
You know, I personally don't have a staff, so it's just me in here. You know?
What has been your biggest, we got to wrap this up, but while you've been alone, have you had any kind of, you know, revelation as an artist or as a writer in your alone time?
Have I had any revelations?
Yes, well, artistically or with your own writing or your life, or when this is over, I want to do this.
Well, when this is over, I want to take a long vacation from New York City. I think a lot of people would like to be out of town for a few months. That is something I would enjoy very much, to go to the countryside for like 60 days.
Yeah.
In terms of writing, you know, it's hard as a film critic because it's harder to see the films now. So you have to get video links and,
right,
you know, I want to watch it on my flat screen. I don't like watching movies on my computer. I have a small laptop.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of fun to sit at my desk and watch a movie. So I want to be able to see it on a television app, mm-hmm, not just at a link that's only available, that I can't see on Roku, you know?
Yes.
So, you know, a certain amount of time is spent trying to figure out, like, how to see things that I want to see, but also not watch them on my computer. So there's a lot of movie theaters, you know, repertory theaters and art houses here in New York that are showing movies on, you know, using links they have, like Anthology Film Archives and the Film Society of Lincoln Center and places like that. And I'd rather not watch them just on my laptop. There's a great thing here called Screen Slate, and they're hosting various live events with filmmakers. In fact, they're doing one tonight with the avant-garde filmmaker Ken Jacobs. That looks really interesting, but it's done through Twitch. You know, so which, you know, I'm not like a big computer guy, you know. And I would love to see that, but it's 7 o'clock, so everyone is starting to pound things and yell out the windows on my block. I don't know if you can hear that or not.
I can hear it.
Yeah. So that's how we know it's 7 o'clock now. But, you know, I don't know if that answered your question, but now it's hard to hear you because a man is pounding a pot in my ear with the metal.
That's a good way to end the discussion. Well, thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Let
me show my book again. It's called The Earth Dies Streaming.
Earth Dies Streaming. Get the book. Fantastic writing, and if you're a cineast like I am, you will thoroughly enjoy it. I'll probably be talking about it next week.
I hope so. And it's available as an ebook now too.
As an ebook, I can't wait to read it. And then when you get
out,
you'll have to come back. And we're
we'll
continue our Connecticut discussions.
I look forward to that. Nice to meet you both.
Nice to meet you. Okay,
thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Bye. So much. I love hearing the pots. As we end the show, Jeff and Ryan, as I always say, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's the end of our movie for today. So thanks so much, Jeff. I'll see you next week, same time.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.